happened. So I started off going into juvenile facilities here in Ohio. And that ultimately grew into this thing where I was, you know, going to high schools, because I also realized that I was in high school and I wasn't learning anything. You know, it's this thing that Carl Jung talked about, directed thinking and fantasy thinking. And I was absorbed in the fantasy side of it. I didn't really know how to connect the dots. And reading was the thing that allowed me to kind of cultivate that sense. And so I wanted to give that as a gift to young people to help them navigate the complexity, because life is complicated. And it's even more complicated when you are poor and disadvantaged, marginalized, and all those other things. And reading, particularly autobiographies, you know, is the thing that helped me. And so I wanted to somehow go back and provide this material to young people.
Keith, thank you very much for spending this time with us live from death row from the Ohio State Prison in Youngstown, Ohio.
Thank you for using GTL.
Ooh, that's what he hears a lot when he's on the phone. Keith Lamar speaking from death row in Ohio. He's scheduled to be executed in 2027. On May 31st, a concert will be held at Joe's Pub here in New York to mark the release of his new album, Live from Death Row. Keith will perform from death row along with the jazz pianist Albert Marquez and others. We also spoke to his lawyer, Keegan Stefan, and Amy Gradea, director of the Justice for Keith Lamar Foundation. And that does it for today's show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
I'm Sequoia Ezekwe for Ear to the Streets of Portland on the best community radio station on the planet, KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
I'm Don Jacobson, host of Movin' On, Fridays right after the noon news. Not only does Movin' On feature folk music, but every Monday through Friday, 5:30 to 7 a.m., you can hear a different host bringing you folk music that is engaging, intelligent, heartfelt, humorous, profound, entertaining, and relevant. It is accessible right here on KBOO. Please take this opportunity to invest in a radio station that dares to bring you folk music that you cannot hear anywhere else. Go to KBOO. KBOO.fm/give, text to KBOO at 44321, or click on donate on your mobile app. Whatever you can afford, your generosity is greatly appreciated. Thank you.
It's time to pack your bags and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a summer of memories with KBOO and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th.
So I think our job is not just, we need to stop this war, of course, but we need, I think, also to make up our minds that we are going to carry on a campaign against war, against militarism, against the stealing of our wealth in order to feed the military-industrial complex, in order to feed the egos of our leaders and the profits of the corporations. We need to do that.
That's Howard Zinn, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Howard Zinn in a Memorial Day special, Against War. In a May 1976 column in the Boston Globe, legendary historian Howard Zinn wrote, "Memorial Day should be a day for putting flowers on graves and planting trees, also for destroying the weapons of death that endanger us more than they protect us, that waste our resources and threaten our children and grandchildren." Sadly, Zinn's column in the Globe was discontinued soon after. And even more sadly, his words ring true today. The permanent war economy goes on its merry way. The military budget is probably over $1 trillion. Our guest today is Howard Zinn. He was perhaps this country's premier radical historian. He literally changed the way we looked at history by emphasizing the resistance and triumphs of ordinary people. He was born in Brooklyn in 1922. His parents, poor immigrants, were constantly moving to stay, as he once told me, one step ahead of the landlord. During World War II, he saw combat duty as an Air Force bombardier. He was among the first to oppose U.S. aggression in Indochina and later wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. A principled opponent of imperialism and militarism, he was an advocate of nonviolent civil disobedience. He passed away in 2010. His work continues to inform and inspire me and many others. This alternative radio classic was recorded in 2006 at the University of Texas in Austin. And now, Howard Zinn, Against War.
I came across an interesting quotation. Maybe some of you have heard this, and when I heard it, I was sort of startled. It was a quote from Hermann Göring. Any of you have talked lately to Hermann Göring? But you remember Hermann Göring, right? Some of you. I never know what people know, you know, who weren't born when I was born, but lived when I was, but you know, Hermann Göring, second in command to Adolf Hitler, head of the Luftwaffe. When he was in his cell during the Nuremberg trials after World War II, when all the Nazis were, you know, rounded up in their cells, there was a psychologist who was assigned, a German-speaking psychologist, who was assigned to interview Göring. And he took notes, and he kept a diary. And they talked about all sorts of things. You know, when you're in jail, you got plenty of time. Talk about lots of things. And here's what he reports Göring saying. Why, of course the people don't want war. Why would some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war? But after all, it's the leaders of the country who determine the policy. The people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. All you have to do is tell them that they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country. What struck me was the any country, not just Nazism, not just in Nazi countries, but in so-called democratic countries. Works the same way. It's a little disturbing to think that there are characteristics that are common to fascist countries and so-called democratic countries, but that certainly is one characteristic that they have absolutely in common. I mean, we recognize it. It rings true to what we see around us today. But it leads you to the question of why is it? Why can people be led, as Göring says, why can people be led to go to war? And there's a kind of immediate answer that I think most of us would have. They watch television. They read the newspapers. And the newspapers and television and the media are obsequious followers of government policy. You know, we've had so, you know, have so many examples of that. And I was thinking of the time that Colin Powell, remember, a month before we invaded Iraq, Colin Powell went before the United Nations and he rattled off all these impressive statistics with all this evidence and pictures and graphs and so on. I love those people who get up there with pictures and graphs and so on. They're so smart and so dumb and so immoral, you see. I don't want to connect graphs with immorality, but I always do, you see. Powell, you know, gave figures on how many, you know, metric tons of chemical weapons and biological, you know, it was, you know, very impressive. The New York Times was just beside itself with praise after he, you know. We know now, of course, that this is probably, you know, the champion of speeches filled with lies. It was hard to find any speech that contained, for every cubic inch, more lies, you see. But the New York Times, wow, this was great. The Washington Post said, oh, the editorial in the Washington Post was headed irrefutable, and said that after Powell's talk, it's hard to imagine how anyone could doubt that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction. Well, then the question becomes, why would people believe, not just the government, but the press? And I think the answer has to do with history, or the lack of it, or the lack of historical perspective. Because if you don't have any history, if you don't know any history, it's as if you were born yesterday. And if you were born yesterday, any leader can get up there and say something, or any newspaper can tell you anything, and you have no basis for questioning it. Any leader, any person of authority can get up there and say, oh, we've got to go to war for liberty, for democracy, because we're in danger, and so on. And if you don't have any history, well, you really don't have any basis for questioning that. If you had some, knew some history, and I'm talking now about honest history. I'm not talking about the history we get in school. You know, I'm not talking about the history which is subservient to, you know, the presidents and the congresses and the Supreme Courts and the establishment, and recounts the things they do for us all the time. No, I'm talking about a different kind of history, an honest history. And if you know that history, know even some of that history, you know how often presidents have lied to the American public. Well, you take a look at the Mexican War. You see, Polk lied to the nation about why we went to war with Mexico. You know, oh, well, it had to do with Texas, of course. So much has to do with Texas. You see, I'm going to blame Texas for everything, you know. A clash on the, you know, there's always a precipitating event. You see, American blood has been shed on American soil and all of that. No, it was land. But Polk lied to the nation. Just as McKinley later, at the end of the 19th century, lied to the nation about why we were going into Cuba. We're going to Cuba to liberate the Cubans from Spain. Didn't say we're going into Cuba because we want to go into Cuba. Because our corporations are dying to get into Cuba. Because United Fruit and the railroads and the banks want to get it. No, we're going to liberate the Cubans. And we're going to the Philippines, McKinley said, to civilize the Filipinos. We're always civilizing people, you see. And but didn't say why we really wanted the Philippines. Lies upon lies. You know, Wilson lied to the nation, we're going to go to war, World War I, to make the world safe for democracy. The lies went on and on. Yes, even Roosevelt lied, in a certain sense, by omission, by not really telling the story about America, of all the provocations that went on between the United States and Japan before Pearl Harbor. Harry Truman lied when he told the nation that the atomic bomb was dropped. Listen to this. The atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima was dropped on a military target. Those were his words, on a military target. And of course, everybody lied about Vietnam. John F. Kennedy lied about the extent of our involvement in Vietnam, and didn't tell about the secret bombing missions that American flyers were there when they were just supposed to be advisors. You know, and LBJ lied about the Gulf of Tonkin, and Nixon lied about the secret bombing of Cambodia, and so on. The lies went on and on. Reagan lied about what we, after the Vietnam War, about why we went into Grenada. And the Bush Senior lied about why we went into Panama and destroyed whole neighborhoods and killed several thousand people in Panama. And then, of course, more recently, we've had, again, lies. Lies about Iraq, about the first war. We're going in because because they took Kuwait. And, of course, they did take Kuwait. They did commit an act of aggression, Iraq, Kuwait. But can anyone believe that the senior Bush was just heartbroken over what happened to Kuwait? You know, that he couldn't fathom why one nation would invade another. You know, anyway, there's, oh, by the way, about the Philippines, talking about historical amnesia, I don't know if you saw this, but 4 or 5 years ago, Bush addressed the National Assembly in the Philippines, and he said to them, "America is proud of its part in the great story of the Filipino people. Together, our soldiers liberated the Philippines from colonial rule." Well, if you didn't know any history, you would believe him. If you knew some history, you would know that the United States fought a bloody war against the Filipinos in which more than 500,000 Filipinos were killed, in which atrocities took place against the Filipinos, and then we occupied the Philippines for another 50 years, keeping in power dictatorship after dictatorship in the Philippines. And you'd have to know some history to know what a lie that was. Colin Powell at one point, talk about historical amnesia. Colin Powell was annoyed at one point because the Mexican ambassador to the United States said that the United States was treating Mexico as its backyard. And Colin Powell said something like, "That's not nice. We have too much of a history that we have gone through together." Well, yeah, that's true. But he didn't say what that history was. He didn't say we invaded Mexico and took 45% of its territory. That was our history, you see. It's important to look at the record and to know the history of lies. So the next time anybody gets up before the microphone who represents authority and says we have to go to war, well, you will be very, very skeptical. Rudyard Kipling, I like to quote Rudyard Kipling because he was a great imperialist. But Rudyard Kipling, although he was a great imperialist, had another side to him, and that he had twinges of pain thinking of what imperialism did. And at one point, he said, "If any should," and speaking in one of his poems as a soldier, he said, "If any should ask why we died, tell them because our fathers lied." Anyway, there's another reason, I think, for sort of easy acceptance of what the government tells us and what the press tells us. And this reason is very deeply ingrained in American culture. And it's the idea that we, the people, and the government have a common interest. This is the biggest lie. No, really. But it goes way back. It starts way back with the Constitution and the Founding Fathers and you know, the Constitution starts, "We the people," as if we the people have put together the Constitution instead of 55 rich white men put together the Constitution, you know, and as if black people and Indians and women and working people had something to do. But the myth was, and perpetuated all these years and all these generations, you know, that, yeah, it's our government, it's we the people, it's our Constitution, it's our, and so on. It takes a little history to understand the falsity of that statement, even though the culture goes to great lengths to make us think our interests are the same. You know, the culture has a language that tries to bind us all together. It uses the words national interest, national security, national defense, as if they applied equally to everybody, as if, you know, their security is our security, their defense is our defense, you know, as if, you know, Exxon and I have the same interests, you see. Or as if Bush and the guy he sends to Vietnam have the same interests. No, in the history of this country has been a history of clashing interests. From the very beginning of slave owner versus slave and landlord versus tenant and the rich against the poor. And we have, you're not supposed to talk about class in this country. You're not supposed to suggest that there are classes in this country. It's sort of Marxist. Marx talked about classes. So I suppose James Madison was a Marxist, because James Madison said, before Marx was born, well, otherwise he might have been called a Marxist, you see. But Madison said, you know, the society is divided into groups depending on whether you have property or you don't have property, and there will be an inevitable clash between these groups. They were more candid in those days than our leaders are today. I mean, not only that, but they were more eloquent. Or they could talk. They could write. I've got to hand it to them. Even though they were slave owners and merchants and bondholders, and they fashioned a government that would serve their interests, they were articulate, without monitors. Yeah. But clashes, class conflict, all through American history. You know, in the colonial period before the Revolution, during the Revolution, with the mutinies of privates in Washington's army against the officers in the army. After the Revolution, with the rebellions of farmers in western Massachusetts and New Jersey and South Carolina and Maryland, rebellions of farmers after the Revolution, veterans who had been in the war and now didn't like the lives that they were leading and felt oppressed by the rich. And all through American history, we've had these clashes of those who had and those who did not. It's very important to know that, because if you think that the people up there who get up there before the microphone and tell you you've got a war have your interests at heart, you are making a terrible mistake. You are making a mistake of life and death, a dangerous thing to do. You know, this is going against, when you talk this way, I suddenly find myself talking this way. And if you talk this way, you feel, you're doing something wrong. Because that idea of we're all together, so deeply ingrained, and you learn when you go to school, that they're the three branches of government and they represent us. And if one doesn't represent us, the others will. Because we have checks and balances. That is the biggest lie has it ever been told in any government or civics class, that we have checks and balances. You see, the only checks and balance we have ever had was when the people checked and balanced what the government did by their social movements. You know. Yeah. Another reason why people are led to believe authority from the start is the notion, again, ingrained from early on, that we are a special country, a special nation. We are the best. We are the greatest. We are number one. It's not just that we're number one in this or that, we're number one in virtue. We are the most moral and virtuous. We are the Boy Scouts of the world. We will help countries across the street, you see. That's what we do, you see. And that's what we stand for. It starts very early. It starts with the Pledge of Allegiance, liberty and justice. I mean, you're a kid in first grade. You don't even know what they're talking about. You don't know what you're saying. You're saying liberty and justice for all. And then they force you to sing the Star-Spangled Banner. you know, the land of the free and the home of the brave. And imagine little black kids in the South singing, the land of the free and the home of the brave. Maybe those little black kids know better, but little white kids may not, you know. And then, of course, we were all brought up on God Bless America, our second national anthem, you know. And, you know, and I haven't heard anybody publicly ask, why would God care about this 5% of the world's population, and he is choosing to bless us? You know, why do we deserve it any more than anybody else? When you grow up on this diet of self-congratulation, then it means that, well, the president says, yes, we're going to help other people, and we're going to spread democracy, we're going to spread liberty. If you don't know the history of what we have done to spread liberty in the world, you know, then you might believe it. But if you know some of that history, you will know that at just 6 years after John Winthrop, the governor of Massachusetts, the first governor of Massachusetts, 6 years after John Winthrop proclaims Massachusetts Bay as the city on the hill. So this is the beginning of that idea. Years later, Ronald Reagan embroidered on it the golden city on the hill. You see, we're going to be the cynosure of the world. Everybody would look to us, you see, and that's what Winthrop was talking about, the city on the hill. And 6 years after that, the city on the hill massacred 600 Pequot Indians, men, women, and children. That was a sign of what was to come. And this this especially virtuous nation then marauded across the country and committed one of the great acts of ethnic cleansing in history by annihilating Indian tribes and massacring them and driving them out of their lands. That was just the beginning of a history which is hardly virtuous. But then, you know, going into Mexico and sending our troops into Central America and sending the Marines into the Caribbean again and again and again, and taking Cuba and taking the Philippines and taking Hawaii, and then the wars go on and on, and the aggression goes on and on, and the aggression becomes particularly blatant after World War II, when we are now one of the great superpowers, one of the two great superpowers of the world. It's very interesting that exactly at that moment, that is at the end of World War II, when the United States is going to move from its rather limited imperial activities, mostly in the Western Hemisphere and out in the Philippines, it's going to move from that into all the other areas of the world and really become the number one war-making power of the world. Exactly at that point, the Department of War changes its name to Department of Defense. Thinking of our reputation as an especially virtuous nation, not like the others, say. I wanted to read to you a little of Langston Hughes, you know, a black poet of the Harlem Renaissance of the 20s and 30s, called before the House Un-American Activities Committee, which is one of the best things you can say about anybody. he wrote this poem called Columbia representing the United States. Columbia, my dear girl, you really haven't been a virgin so long. It's ludicrous to keep up the pretext. You're terribly involved in world assignations, and everybody knows it. You've slept with all the big powers in military uniforms, and you've taken the sweet life of all the little brown fellows in loincloths and cotton trousers. When they've resisted, you've yelled rape, being one of the world's big vampires. Why don't you come out and say so, like Japan and England and France and all the other nymphomaniacs of power? A little harsh. But black people have generally been more reluctant to go along with the glory of American empire than other people. I can't imagine why, you see, but they have. Now, I'm thinking of Zora Neale Hurston, that great, wonderful, unusual writer who would take no crap from anybody. from white people, from black people, from anybody. She was just her own person. And she was just said what she felt. And in the midst of World War II, the great war against fascism, everybody is for it and so on. And she is saying, I can't get excited when I see, you know, that, oh, yes, Hitler is overrunning Europe. And it's true. But what about England overrunning Asia? And what about Holland overrunning Africa? And Belgium running over Central Africa? And what about all these Western powers overrunning the darker peoples of the world? And when Truman dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, she called him the butcher of Asia. She wrote some of this in her autobiography, Dust Tracks on the Road, and the publisher cut out the parts that were critical of the United States during World War II. They were only restored years later, you know, after the war was over. Just an example of the notion that we are different. In 1899, which was just about at the beginning of our bloody war in the Philippines, the Secretary of War, Elihu Root, said, "The American soldier is different from all other soldiers of all other countries since the world began. He is the advance guard of liberty and justice, of law and order, and of peace and happiness." You know, you read those words. Oh, time.
No.
Oh, I got scared. You know, so I'm easily intimidated by people who are in charge of meetings. Yeah. Talking to the microphone. Yeah. Oh, nobody has heard anything that I've said. Okay. I'm going to start all over.